All right. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. So we'll get started where everyone else does. As far as earliest childhood memories, what are we getting into?
My earliest childhood memories, it would be when I'm about 3 years old, sitting in my grandmother's arms at a Chinese restaurant that she ran.
Okay. Okay. Was that something that stayed in your family for a while, or were you just there quite a bit?
My grandparents were in the restaurant business. My mom and her siblings worked in it too. And as a small child, I was there sitting behind the counter, counting coins and, helping out.
Okay. Okay. So from there, let's say elementary school time, what are we getting into? Are we allowed to hang out outside, or did we have to go straight to the business? What did our days look like?
My parents are both educators. My father is a college professor and my mom is a preschool teacher. And they were free range parents. They were definitely of the kind that said, go out, climb a tree, break a leg, take risk, and find your own journey. And I always remember very specifically that my mother, that my brothers and I would ask my mom, why aren't we going to summer camp? All the other kids get to go to summer camp. Why don't we go? And she said, to us, we're very small at this time. It's because you need to make your own journey in the summer. And you need to find ways to look after yourself. She would go to work, read books, go on adventures, cook for yourself, things like this. And we were all very small. Yeah. And so that created a very strong sense of independence. And that continued into my adult life my teenage life, I should say, where I would go back to Australia from America every summer, sometimes on my own. I would go to Switzerland to spend the Easter break with my godparents, often traveling on my own. Mm-hmm. And then when I graduated from high school, I graduated from Shaker Heights High School outside of Cleveland, Ohio. And I didn't do what everyone else did, which was go to college locally or in the US. I decided to go all the way back to Australia and go to university in my home country after being away for all of my life, and making a big step in a degree of being independent.
I was going to interrupt a bit. So when you're a young child and your parents, are they conveying these things, or are you just repeating exactly what they said as far as like go out? Or because I have a 2-year-old and we're very much like, this is what we're looking for. we're finding for her to do things on her own. Like, obviously supervised as she is too, but we're not trying to direct her as much. How did you feel like, when did it click for you that like, this is kind of what I'm doing, or this is what my parents want?
I remember sitting on a train with my mother. I was probably about 14 years old, and my mom, I was sort of talking to her about like where I was going to go to college and what I wanted to do. And I probably said something, I should become like a lawyer or a banker or something like that so I can make money. And she said, son, you should focus on what you want to do, because we are always here to support you. And if you want to be an artist or an academic, or you want to make a contribution to the world in a different way, go off and do that. Go and try and do that. Don't solve for just, making the most money. That was a very reassuring thing. And actually that sense of security, that knowing that my family was always behind me, no matter what happened, was very powerful. And that really is what enabled me to become an entrepreneur.
Have you ever asked your mother or found out like from your parents where that perspective for them came from?
Both my parents are immigrants. So they're people who, in my father's case, he's was born in India. And he, as quite a young man, moved to Australia and to the United States to pursue his education. Took that risk to move somewhere new, just as his parents did. He was recounting recently that his parents left their ancestral village and never went back. And even though it was in the same country, I know this because I was sort of drawing a family tree recently, and my dad doesn't know the names of his grandparents. Because, when his parents left the village, they didn't, they went to the city, and for really economic reasons, could never go back and see their parents. And they were independent from the time they were teenagers. And my dad followed in the same way, and so did I.
Okay, so we're pushing a lot of independence as a child. In middle school, were you ever getting into mischief? Did you ever need any correction in course, or how were those things handled for you at a young age?
Well, I was always rebellious against kind of the institutional powers that be, particularly the school curriculum. I remember maybe it was in my freshman year of high school, and I was in sort of a heated argument with a teacher, and I said to her, the only reason that you, the teacher, can act like this is because you have your union to protect you. And she looked mortified that, I guess a 13-year-old Aaron D'Souza knew that it was the teacher's union that really protected their, their system of dysfunction, right? I unraveled that.
So at 13, do you have just a bunch of your friends that are kind of having the same discussions, and then you figure out it's the union? Are your parents feeding you little tidbits of information? Like
Oh
how are you coming
no,
up with
but
this?
I've always been a voracious reader, and a huge consumer of information, and I often say, I've had the privilege of attending some of the finest educational institutions in the world, but by and large, I've taught myself everything, and it's one of those things that I went to Oxford University to go to law school. You find that these like really extraordinary institutions that the students are actually so smart that they just teach themselves everything, right? The coursework is actually almost meaningless, because if you've been instilled with that love of learning from a young age, then you're very inclined to consume information on your own and teach yourself, and the quest for knowledge is something that inspires me to this day.
So in high school, were you worried about grades? Were you worried, like what were your goals when you're in high school? Not necessarily like years out, but as the weeks and months went by, like how did you know like, hey, I'm actually going to study for this? Or were you always a good study, or what did your school look like?
Well, in high school, my primary goal was to get out. By time I'm like a freshman in high school, I realize, I'm gay. I'm in, conservative middle America, and I'm just like, I just want to get out.
What,
I want to be
where were you? Sorry.
outside of Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Right. And after 9/11, this is when this like really accelerated. I thought, America was falling apart. I don't really want to be, in the system, particularly as being a foreigner. So much of my goal was just to graduate as quickly as possible and go to university. And that's what I did. I graduated early, went straight to university, and then, found myself and became free and open, and have had a wonderful time ever since.
Did you play any athletics in school? Did you do any extracurricular things in school? What did that look like?
I really didn't find sports until I was at university. I took up competitive cycling, did very well at that. I played rugby at Oxford, which has always and continues to be a great part of my life. But in high school, certainly nothing athletic, and you know, my main focus was how do I graduate as quickly as humanly possible. And then when I got to university, I, you know, you're sort of presented with a lot of choice, right? You know, what do you major in? What classes do you take, et cetera? And I remember on my very, very first day of university as an undergraduate, day one of freshman year, I sat down with like one of the course counselors where you're sort of picking your classes and things. And I said to her, oh, you know what? I actually looked at the course manual, which is this big bureaucratic document. I read it end to end. And I think I can actually, instead of getting one major, I could actually get three and I can do it in 2 years. And she was like, what are you talking about? You can't do that. I was like, no. It's like, and I sort of pull out this long bureaucratic document. I'm like, well, you know, I have to take these classes in this order, da, 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 da. And she was like, we better go and see the dean. And so we literally went to go and see the dean. And he was like, I don't think anyone's ever read this document. I was like, why did you read it? I was like, you emailed it to me, so I read it. And this is the rules of the game. And if I'm going to play the game, I want to understand the rules. And so this is something that's very important, has guided my entire life, which is most people say that life is just a game. And they mean this in a pejorative way. They mean that it's out of their control. However, the question of games is very important in both analytical philosophy and in economics. And you have to distinguish at first between what is a game and what is play, mere play. So, you know, when I'm throwing around a football with my brothers after Thanksgiving, that's play. But, you know, when the Jacksonville Jaguars are playing, you know, the Cleveland Browns, that's a game. And games have a defined field of play. They have opposing sides. They have a set of rules. They usually have a fixed time horizon, and they have winners and losers. And so before I embark upon any journey in my life, I think to myself, what is the game that I am playing? What is the field of play? Who are the players on the field? What are the rules, and what is winning?
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you one very important fact. You can't understand how to play a game while you're on the field. You have to observe it from the outside as a spectator, as a coach, as an observer, to understand what is going on, to really study the rule set and understand the parameters of the game. And once you've fully understood the game, then you go onto the field and play, and then you win.
So how often when you read something and you, for this as it showed that you were the first one to be like, oh, I can finish with three majors in 2 years. How often do you have self doubt in your head where it's like, oh, so if this was true, someone probably would have done it before me? Or had you always trailblazed a fair amount in your life?
Never there is self doubt. And I sat in Arnold Schwarzenegger's office in Santa Monica, California, and had a very similar conversation with Governor Schwarzenegger and his team and about game theory. And he pulled out a letter, and it was from Nelson Mandela. And it said, "Dear Arnold, everything is impossible until someone does it. Regards, Nelson." That sort of stuck with me, right? And so, yes, it seems hard, but just because someone hasn't done it doesn't make it impossible. And it makes it even more opportune in so many ways, right? And finding if you fully understand a system, then even if no one has ever embarked upon that journey before, it becomes a very knowable pathway.
So we've gotten a lot of good information here. I don't want to just glance past the hanging out with Arnold part. how does that happen, and what was the instance?
So after I graduated from Oxford, I went to go work for Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal. And I led Peter's litigation against Gawker Media involving the wrestler Hulk Hogan.
Okay.
where we won one of the largest invasion of privacy judgments in history. And it was the subject of a best-selling book by the New York Times best-selling author Ryan Holiday called Conspiracy, which documented how we, in complete secret, caused the bankruptcy of one of the largest media companies in the world. Governor Schwarzenegger's team actually had read the book. And Governor Schwarzenegger reached out to Ryan Holiday, and Ryan then connected me with his team, and that's how we came to have a discussion. And at that time, he was very interested in litigating against the oil companies
Okay.
on a similar level, and I sort of showed how this could be. But it was a very costly and complex endeavor, which really never went anywhere.
So I saw an inkling of excitement when you were mentioning Arnold there. Is there a moment in which you get a text or an email and you're sitting next to somebody and they're like, "Hey, Arnold wants to talk to you," and you get pumped up? Or do you just do so many things? It's just, Arnold, all right, I'll see if I have time.
No, I'm honored always when extraordinary figures reach out and want my advice. But it happens reasonably frequently these days.
So what is it that pumps you up then, if we'll say either college or after, other than, or was it just your work that was exciting you so much, or did you have anything else that you were reaching for that was exciting as well?
Well, my work is, I've never worked a traditional job. I've
Okay.
never gone and worked at a desk for someone else. I've always been building businesses on my own, and my whole career has been as an entrepreneur. So I've built and sold three companies. I led the Gawker litigation and now building the Enhanced Games. And so everything that I do is for myself to solve an overarching social and economic problem.
Gotcha. So I'm going to rewind a little bit because 2 years, 3 degrees, a couple things going on there. What were the degrees in, and why did you choose three?
The degrees that I, the university degrees that I have. So I actually have f five university degrees. So I have two undergraduate degrees in sociology, politics, and art history. I have a PhD in intellectual property law. I have a law degree and a master's degree. Initially, when I graduated from high school, my intention was to be an academic and follow in the footsteps of my parents and teach. But really, what occurred to me is that one really shouldn't go off and teach if you don't really have any life experience. And so I got my PhD. I was in my early 20s, I didn't feel really that I was really that well prepared for teaching because I didn't really know anything. So I decided to get a law degree. So I could practice law, but I had a PhD in legal philosophy. And while in my very first week at Oxford, I met Peter Thiel. We became great friends. In our very first meeting, I said to him, "What is your greatest problem, and how can I help you?" And he said, "Well, there's this tabloid media outlet that's writing all this junk about me." And I said, "Well, why don't you sue them?" He had all these reasons why he didn't want to sue them. I said, "Well, why don't you find someone who wants to sue them but doesn't have the resources to do so?" And he said, "Oh, that's an interesting idea. So I'll write you a paper on it." 2 weeks later, I'd written a paper. We met up for dinner. I sort of pitched him on the idea. And he said, "How much and how long would it take to bankrupt Gawker?" And I said, "5 years and $10 million. Remember, I'm 24 years old at this point in time. I'd never done anything with my life." And he was like, "Great. Where do I wire the money?" And that was that.
Hey,
and,
there's another one of those big smiles that I'm now we're getting somewhere. that pumped you up.
if there was one more moment in my life that made the whole show, it was that. Where, you know, just 24-year-old me could go off and pitch, you know, literally one of the wealthiest, most powerful men in the history of the world, and him to say, yes, let's go. And we did. And it's been it was a fabulous journey, and a very successful one.
So how did you know that it was going to be that amount of time? Not necessarily the money part, but was there precedent already that you were following, or how did you come? You just...
No, I literally had just made this up. I, you know, wanted to as consultants do, under promise and over deliver. So I said, okay, well, you know, give me $10 million in 5 years. Like, you know, with $10 million in 5 years, you should be able to do literally anything.
Okay, good to know. Good to know.
Yeah.
So after you're done with that, are you moving on to something else? Were you working just specifically on that job, or did you have anything in between as well?
No. At the time of running the Gawker litigation, I was also building tech startups in Australia, where I was living at the time, and that was built some successful companies in that space, and have always just continued being an entrepreneur, right, and always finding social problems that have economic upside and creating solutions to them. And so I find it very simple and straightforward now.
When you're working the litigations, I think I'm watching too much Netflix at this point while talking to you, but so I watched the show Suits, and I never really...
Something like that. It's nothing like that.
My stepmom, she's worked with lawyers. She does a lot of the research. I know some lawyers, and they seem to be in court all the time. Like, how do you, what are you doing that takes so much time as a lawyer? Or what were you doing it wasn't all of the time?
Well, let's be very clear. I wasn't the lead lawyer on the case. I was the lead strategist.
Okay.
And so our success in the Gawker lawsuit was not about just legal maneuvering. It was about a much wider analysis of the company, of its capital structure, of its revenue streams, of its position in the market. And so I always say that if you are a hammer, you think everything is a nail. And so lawyers like to use the arsenal to fight legal problems, just as doctors like to use their tools to fight disease. Mm-hmm. And actually, to pull off something like the Gawker litigation, the bankruptcy of Gawker, was so much more than law, right? It was understanding their customers, their employees, their position in the market, how they're competing with other media outlets, how the sort of this love-hate relationship between different kinds of media outlets. And that was that overarching strategy. And so there's a question I always ask Peter. I said, you know, Peter, why did you pick me? You know, I was a skilled academic, but I had never practiced law. You could go off to the biggest law firms in New York City and hire the most experienced counsel, who would do this a much better job. And he said, absolutely not, right? Because we were doing something so new and so novel that the lawyers, you know, the experienced lawyers, the partners of the big firms would approach it like they've approached everything else in their career.
Gotcha.
As a purely legal exercise. And this was so much more. And that's why the outcome was unique, right? We won the largest invasion of privacy judgment by some measures in history. That only happened because we had approached it from this very new and novel way. And so, you know, the analogy is, it's like, you know, Reed Hastings, who founded Netflix, never worked at Blockbuster. Travis Klenick never worked at Uber, founder of Uber, never worked, you know, in a taxi cab.
Yeah.
Right. And so many times in the journey of innovation, it's much better to start with a blank slate, and having years or decades of experience in a particular field clouds your worldview on so many levels. It sort of forces you to act in a certain way. And actually, beginning with a blank slate is much easier.
Okay, there we go. So you have a lot of things going on. What do you do for your physical and mental health when you're just starting your, as you are the strategist for the lawyer and then starting companies as well?
Well, I'm 38 years old now, and I've been sort of in the business of building companies for 15 years. Getting on to 20 years now. The greatest hack that I ever had was I was with my great friend Randy Krosner, former governor of the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank, and he was staying over at my house in Australia. And I said to him, "Randy, you're like 50 years old, but you look like you're a teenager. Or you look so healthy and young." And he said to me, "Aaron, I haven't had alcohol or caffeine for years, for decades." And that day I went cold turkey.
Okay.
Right. So that day I stopped drinking all caffeine, and that was over a decade ago. And then a few years later I stopped drinking alcohol. And that has been the biggest game changer. It feels like almost like having a superpower, right? In terms of health and wellness. And so, as president of the Enhanced Games, a lot of people come to me and say, "Oh, what enhancements are you on?" And I said, the first step of any health optimization journey is to remove toxins from your life, right? And that starts with caffeine, stimulants, alcohol, recreational drugs, processed food. And if you can remove all of those things, you'll feel like you are a Superman and you can do absolutely anything, right? We're recording this interview just a few days after the new year. Most of my friends still have hangovers. They're not at work. I'm actually sitting here in my office looking out, and like all the lights are off because literally no one is here. I'm the only person here in the office. And why is that? I've removed so many of the negative stressors from my life. And I feel stronger, fitter, and faster now than even when I was a teenager.
So, what was your relationship with food and alcohol before the giving it up?
Well, I never drank very much. Like I would never say I was a problem drinker. But the thing is that when you're running a ambitious company, you don't work in weeks or months. You work in hours and minutes. And if I had a glass of wine at dinner, I wouldn't go back to work afterwards, right? I wouldn't answer my emails. Yet now, after dinner, I just spend 15 minutes on my emails. I respond to my team all around the world, and that keeps the velocity of our organization much higher, right? So I'm responsive at 6 a.m. as much as I am at midnight with the same high quality, which means that we move twice or three times as fast as an organization where the CEO only responds during working hours, right? And there's like a huge compound effect to that.
So, do you have somebody meal prepping for you and bring it to you, or how does the food part work for you?
I really enjoy cooking.
Okay.
I really enjoy cooking. And my fundamental food philosophy is if it doesn't rot, you shouldn't eat it. And so if anything that's like shelf stable is probably bad for you, right? It's like so hard. Like there's so much information about food, so much of it is conflicting. Our seed oil is good for you, our seed oil is bad for you, and you just never know, right? And so my general worldview is if it doesn't rot, you shouldn't eat it. So it's like anything that is shelf stable is probably bad for you. And the quest of food over human history has been about food preservation, right? And actually now that we live in the era of the airplane and instant deliveries and so forth, the fresh foods, we can eat fresh food all the time. And so I eat a lot of meat and protein. and vegetables. That's all very fresh, and I love cooking for myself. And I never meal prep.
Okay.
This is, you should eat fresh and healthy. So, but that's like my fundamental food analysis, and it's a
So
very simple one.
most people generally have like 8 to 10 go-to meals, but I feel like such a world traveler such as yourself, and you probably have extensive menus wherever you've gone. How do you pick out what you're going to be eating since you have such a large library?
Oh, I'm actually quite the opposite.
Okay.
I've traveled everywhere. I think I've probably been to like 50 countries. I've lived in 12 cities. While I enjoy local cuisine occasionally, I actually try and eat out as little as possible, and I cook for myself as much as I can. And it's usually just protein. This is like usually chicken and broccoli. That's it. If I could just eat chicken, broccoli, all the time, I'd be a very happy person. Brett Fraser, who's the chief athletes officer of the Enhanced Games and a three-time Olympian, he said, "If you want to have the body of your dreams, if you just eat chicken, broccoli, and brown rice, you will have it." It's simple. Just eat chicken,
And
broccoli, and brown rice.
it seems to be working quite well.
So,
So,
abs are made in the kitchen.
hey, there you go. Where did the enhanced games come from for you?
In many ways, it's a lot of different ideas that were stewing in my mind for a long time.
Okay.
So I've always admired the Olympics. I just think it inspires the world in such a brilliant way. But at the same time, the International Olympic Committee just doesn't really work that well.
Okay.
Budgets always go over. There's always corruption scandals, and the athletes aren't getting paid. And I read a paper by Professor Julian Savulescu, who's a bioethicist at Oxford, arguing for an enhanced Olympics. And he wrote that paper, I won't say almost 20 years ago. And it was just some academic, and it just sat there and didn't go anywhere. And I was at Equinox Gym in South Beach, Miami, watching an Instagram reel of a bodybuilder who was going around a gym asking people if they were natural or enhanced.
Yep.
And I thought to myself, that's really interesting. People are like open about being enhanced. So I went around the gym and I just talked to any person there and I said, "Are you natural or enhanced?"
How did
And so many
that
people. Oh, people were like, "Oh yeah, I'm enhanced. I'm on TRT. Are you thinking about doing it?" And they were just so open
Yeah.
about sharing this. So for a few days, every time I would go to the gym and I'd see someone who's like jacked or doing like a serious amount of lifting, I would just go up to them. I was like, "Oh, are you enhanced?" And they were all very open and honest. And I would say 20% of the people at that gym were using performance enhancements. And I thought to myself, we're at the vanguard of a social change here, right? And then I learned that 44% of Olympians have used banned performance enhancements and only 1% get caught.
Wow.
And I was like, there's a serious opportunity here to build a sporting event where we don't need to hide and do this all out of the open. And I now, and as I said, I'm an out proud gay man. And the journey of enhanced athletes today is a lot like being gay 50 years ago.
Okay.
It's secret, it's shameful, it's done in the dark alley, but it's kind of fun. And I thought to myself, well, what changed about being gay? Well, pride happened, Stonewall happened, right? Where a few small individuals were willing to come out and be public. Remember, the first Pride was not sponsored by HSBC or Citibank. It was literally some guys getting beaten up in a park
Okay.
in New York City and in London and Berlin. And that built a social movement. And so it was very hard to find the first athletes, the first scientists who were willing to commit their name to being part of this wider endeavor,
Gotcha.
to be the first individual who openly say, we support science. in sports. We believe in science. Science is real. But now that's a serious movement of people, right? It took courage. It took immense courage on the part of everyone involved in the Enhanced Games movement to make that first step. And now we have the support of some of the biggest investors in the world. And we're going to produce an event that's going to break all the world records.
So when,
and who's going to want to watch the old slow Olympics when you can watch the fast, modern Enhanced Games?
Yeah. Well, I think there's some tough things as well when it comes to the Olympics. For example, you said you played rugby. I know some of the smaller population countries, they don't get as favorable as draws when they're playing games. They're usually a little bit tighter. They get less rest, things of that nature. And I've had some people on that they say they want to walk out with their flag, but the walk is sometimes 2 to 6 hours or whatever it is, and they have an event, so they get to miss that. And because they have to recover and be prepared to run the next day and stuff like that. So how do you see yourself differentiating other than the enhanced portion of the games?
Oh, on so many levels. Number one, the athletes will be paid. Okay. Excellence deserves to be rewarded. The average Olympian exists on less than $30,000 a year. And even winning a gold medal isn't a guarantee of sponsorship. Yes, if you win a 100 meter gold medal, you might do well. But if you win a gold medal in javelin, you know, your best sponsors might be your local hardware store.
Mm-hmm.
And so delivering an economic model that allows athletes to be paid and be paid really well, that's of paramount importance to us. And how do we do that? Well, you know, the Olympics brings in billions in revenue, but they waste even more building stadiums. They build a dozen stadiums and then they throw them away after 2 weeks, right? And so in designing the Enhanced Games, we said, number one, what are the sports that people actually care about? They don't care about badminton. They don't care about curling. You know, what are the sports that people actually care about that have the highest television and social media impact?
Okay.
That have the lowest infrastructural delivery costs. So velodrome cycling, for example, requires building a $300 million facility, right? There are only a few thousand people in the world who participate in velodrome cycling, right? It's pointless to have that as a sport, right? Biathlon, right? Where you're like skiing and shooting at the same, the weirdest sport, right? No one watches it. No one participates in it. And so let's focus on the sports that matter, that can be delivered cost effectively, and therefore we can share the profits with the athletes.
Okay.
And ultimately, we're going to break all the world records. Number one, because of pharmacological enhancements, but more so because of offering financial security to the athletes. If they can train full-time and they can be focused, they will deliver a better outcome. And the Olympics aren't interested in that.
So
the highest paid people in international sports are the bureaucrats. So if you look at the athletics world or the swimming world, the highest paid people are the administrators. They're not the athletes. And that's just wrong.
So you obviously you've dealt with and you see how that stuff works. Why do countries or cities try to bid so hard to get it if financially it usually hurts the city that ends up winning the bid? That's never really made sense to me.
Well, it used to be that a dozen cities would bid for the Olympic Games. So when, you know, Sydney and Atlanta were bidding, a dozen cities would bid. And now cities, particularly in Western democracies, realize it's not a very good economic model.
Right.
And so fewer and fewer cities are bidding. And that's why the Olympics keep going back to China and to Russia. And to other despotic nations, because they're willing to do this to sportswash their reputation.
Okay.
Right. And that's why, you know, the FIFA World Cup went to Qatar, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a tiny little country that had to build air conditioned stadiums because they're trying to raise their reputation on an international level. You know, basically gloss over human rights abuses. And that's a very well documented phenomenon that is particularly happening in Saudi Arabia at the moment. And, you know, it's the reality is that Western cities in liberal democracies do not want to host the Olympic Games because it's just too expensive.
So how do you, so since you've been able to find a cost-effective way to do this, are you now having cities bid on this as well, or you are going to have it at the same place?
So we are not interested in leeching off the taxpayer.
Okay.
We don't want taxpayer subsidies.
Thank you.
We're going to operate like the NFL or Formula One or Wimbledon or Major League Baseball, right? Literally, it's a very simple and straightforward proposition. We literally go and book a stadium,
Okay.
right, that already exists. We hire event production companies to roll out, a track and the other equipment necessary and produce an event. We don't have to build new stadiums. We don't have to fly in tens of thousands of athletes because at the Olympic Games, most of those athletes have no chance at medaling, right? It's just a free taxpayer-funded holiday, if it is taxpayer-funded. Sometimes it's not. And so we are interested in focusing on the sports that matter, on the athletes that have the potential to medal and to break world records. And therefore, we can run a much smaller event in terms of its physical footprint, whilst having as large, if not a larger, television and social media impact.
Okay. So when we say enhanced, I was talking to my cousin about this the other day. What's the difference between the general TRT and the extra fancy stuff that the professional athletes are on these days?
Well, TRT would get you banned from Olympic competition. That's
Okay.
actually one of the most common performance enhancements. It's perfectly legal under clinical supervision in many jurisdictions. And the International Olympic Committee likes to say that when they ban a drug, it's illegal. That is, in fact, not true. If you walk into GNC, 25% of the goods on the shelves there will get you banned from Olympic competition, but they're perfectly legal, right? And most of the performance therapies are perfectly legal under clinical supervision. So, what we want to do is show the world and be honest about this. So, when Lance Armstrong was winning all those Tour de Frances, when Barry Bonds was hitting all those home runs, or when Ben Johnson or Marion Jones was breaking all the records on the track, right? It's not just hard work. It's also science. And what I analogize this to is like Formula One. Formula One is a combination of the athlete and the engineer. And Formula One has gotten faster and safer, and the cars have gotten lighter over the last 30 years because of improvements in technology. In the same way, the Enhanced Games is a combination of the athlete and the scientists, right? And it will be faster and it will be safer than traditional sports, because we're very open and honest about what scientific enhancements are being used. But just like Formula One, that technology will diffuse out into the wider world. The reason you have anti-lock brakes in your car is because they were invented on for the F1 track, right? And the technology that will be used to make athletes faster will diffuse out into the wider world, because when someone breaks the 100-meter world record, the first question everyone is going to ask is, what is he on and how do I get it?
Okay.
Because don't you want to be faster, stronger, and younger for longer?
So, are you gonna be having an enhanced line of enhancements? Is that gonna be the sponsorship in the commercials?
We do hope to bring FDA approved, clinically verified enhancements to market that makes our population faster and stronger and younger for longer. Because ultimately, the biggest challenge the Western world faces is an aging population. And as public policymakers, they don't have an answer. They say, oh, well, population is aging, people don't want to have children anymore. It's hard to change the retirement age. And so we just have to import more people to hold up the system. And that's not working very well at the moment. But there is a technological solution. There's a technological solution, and it exists. And it is called performance enhancements. And you only need to look at the present race for the presidency of the United States to see this in the most demonstrable form. You have Joe Biden and Donald Trump, who are both suffering very ill health. But then you have Robert F. Kennedy, who's a similar age. But RFK is an enhanced human. He openly takes TRT, which will get him banned from Olympic competition. And watch the videos. He's doing pull-ups, he's doing push-ups, and he is a much healthier leader than both Trump or Biden. And if anyone should be supporting performance enhancements, it should be Joe Biden.
That would be, I think that would turn his whole campaign around.
Absolutely, right. Like being president of the United States as an 80-year-old is hard. It's hard for anyone.
So
And he
how
should
do
be
you
as possible.
so how do you sell that to the people that aren't going to do any research on it? They just know that one person at the gym that took steroids or bodybuilders die from their heart working too hard. Like what is the selling point? Is the enhanced games, or where do you show that there's less danger than what people think?
Let's be very clear. Drug testing is not about safety, it's about fairness.
Okay.
Lance Armstrong can't use the super steroids when everyone else doesn't have access to them. The enhanced games will be the safest sporting event in history because instead of focusing on the fairness of performance enhancements, we're focusing on athlete safety. And so every athlete who competes will get a full system health checkup. They will get a blood work done, echocardiograms, etc. in a safety protocol that is being designed by top scientists, and we will make sure that they are healthy to compete. They will not have an enlarged heart. They will not have other biomarkers that would put them at significant risk. And the reason why the Olympics and other sporting events don't do this is because it's expensive. It's five to $10,000 per athlete to do that health screening, but we will do that, right? And why will we do that? Because number one, it's the right thing to do, but
Okay.
number two, it's also the best thing for science, because gathering that data about what makes an athlete healthy or not, based on their physiology, based on their training, based on their supplementation regime and their enhancement regime, is all data that we can use to inform new clinical discoveries and new applications of existing compounds.
Gotcha. So we're not throwing everything in the kitchen sink just to get them to get that world record, because I know like there's milkshaking for racehorses. They don't really care about the racehorse. They just want them to be able to push that lactic threshold out or whatever the positive effect of it is.
But think about it in horse racing. When a horse dies on the track, which happens at, the Kentucky Derby, it's terrible for television ratings. It's terrible for the sport, right? I would never allow an athlete to die on track, right? I would never allow an athlete to put themselves at excess risk. Right. But ultimately, individuals should be able to make choices about their body with free and informed consent. And the drug testing regime actually causes significant health risk because athletes know that to get an Olympic gold medal in the 100 meter, you have to take steroids. But there's no question about that. If you want the 100 meter world record, you have to take drugs. But they also take drugs that are designed to beat the test. And so they have to have a very short half-life. They have to be metabolized very quickly. And that's why their liver and kidney toxic, because they have to be digested by your body very, very quickly to beat the drug tests. And so right now, athletes are using compounds that force them to do two things: get results and beat the drug tests. And that causes a health risk because it's not the optimal compound, right? And so if we can use compounds that are optimized for performance without having to hide, then it becomes much, much safer. And this is exactly like being gay in the 1970s. Why did the AIDS outbreak happen? It's because Ronald Reagan didn't want to talk about being gay, but he didn't want to talk about AIDS. And when you drive something into the dark alley, into the shadows, into the black market, it's not safe. But when you do it out in the open, and honest conversations under clinical supervisions, it can be very safe.
Gotcha. Before we get to the last two questions, I've always wanted to see this in the Olympics. Is there an opportunity to have a regular person run next to some of the races?
Yes, and actually, to compete at the Enhanced Games will be a very open opportunity, right? So to compete at the Olympics, you have to be a good athlete and a good politician. You have to navigate this very complex sporting apparatus. To compete at the Enhanced Games, everyone will be invited come to qualification. Anyone they want, right? If you want to run in a banana suit and you think you can break a world record, come, let's do it. Right. I want Mr. Beast there, right? I want Joe Rogan there. I want every influencer in the world saying, you know what? If I can't break the world record, at least I'm going to do it in a funny way, right? So what? Let's be open and to everyone.
Absolutely. All right. So the last two questions. What's your definition of health? Not necessarily the dictionary definition, but what is health to you?
Health is stability. Health is routine. Health is knowing that I wake up in a slightly better version of myself than yesterday. It's constant improvement. And it's always incremental, right? Even within performance enhancements, you're not going to double your speed overnight. You'll get 1 or 2% here or there. And it's all about compound effects and compound interest of investing in yourself.
Love that. And then what's something from your life that people listening to the podcast would be able to take away as a positive?
If I could offer any one piece of advice, the thing that is going to improve your life the most is not reducing your alcohol consumption, it's eliminating it.
Done. I don't drink anyways.
Great. And it's actually becoming much more popular these days. Thank you very much, Alex, for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.